Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Donald Trump has asserted himself with the power of the United States into multiple ceasefires and conflict negotiations. How does this comport with U.S. policy historically, and what might be his motivation? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Since his return to the presidency, Donald Trump has played a particularly intriguing role in several peace and ceasefire negotiations. He stated that he's ended seven wars. While this is likely an overstatement, the U.S. president has played a significant role in some of these negotiations, and specifically to end conflicts, or at least ceasefires, between Thailand and Cambodia, India and Pakistan, the civil war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, an agreement between the DRC and Rwanda, and Armenia and Azerbaijan. He's helped to negotiate deals between Serbia and Kosovo, a ceasefire between Israel and Iran, and a water-sharing agreement based on a dam built in Ethiopia and Egypt's protestations of the use of that dam. So while the president does have a record of overstating some of his accomplishments, it is clear that the U.S. is asserting itself in international negotiations, and it might be fair to say continuing to assert itself in international negotiations. So on today's show, we will explore the impact of the president's involvement in these negotiations. How consistent with the history of American foreign policy is President Trump's interventions on these issues? And put simply, is U.S. involvement helping both negotiate these agreements and implement these agreements? And as a note, today's show is being recorded in front of a live audience at the International Studies Association's West Regional Meetings in Pasadena, California. Our panel today is Amy Scognessi, Professor of International Relations at San Francisco State University. She's the co-author of U.S. Foreign Policy, that's with Stephen Hook, and The Trump Effect, The Perpetuation of Populism in U.S.-China Trade, with Ancita Sherrell. Mary Jane Parmenter is clinical professor and deputy director of the School for the Future of Innovation in Society and also the director of global programs at the Rob Walton College of Global Futures at Arizona State University. She's the author of Cross-National Active Learning in Global Development Studies, Decolonizing the Curriculum, and co-author of a co-created model for self-determined development objectives in indigenous communities. And Louis Hebron, formerly of California State University, Cal State University Monterey Bay, and the editor of Asian Security in the Age of Globalization. I want to thank you all so much for joining us today. And Amy, I'm going to turn to you first. I asked the question, is the U.S.'s intervention in these negotiations, is President Trump sort of keeping with an American foreign policy tradition, or is this a break with the history of American foreign policy in these negotiations?
Doug, it's so great to be here, and it's wonderful, as always, to be at ISA West. Your question's really interesting, because I think one of the expectations around Trump's foreign policy have been that he is an isolationist, or tends to look inward more on domestic politics. This is a trend that we see when we're talking about populists in particular, that they tend to emerge from domestic contexts. They come out of contentious domestic political tensions. And if populists get into leadership, they tend to focus more inward and on themselves. But this has not been the case in Trump's second term in particular. We see that he has decided, and I think it's not just him, but his foreign policy team and advisors, to really initiate himself into lots of different issues. We expected something on trade, for example. We knew he was going to turn more inward on trade and try to pass tariffs, which he has done. But I think the surprise here has been his determination or insert into peace negotiations and conflict negotiations. This was not expected. I think it's in line to a degree with a history of foreign policy. If we look back at other administrations, we see that they often conceive of themselves in leadership as peace negotiations. Biden, for example, was heavily involved in supporting Ukraine, and we've seen him, of course, be involved internationally in lots of different arenas. But for Trump, I think what's interesting is he sees this as part of his own personal legacy, I think. It's more to a degree that goes in line with his view of himself as the great negotiator. It also fits with his style of transactional politics, I think. He thinks he can come in and negotiate great deals, do so rather quickly with a different style than we've seen in the past, often taking one side or the other, as we see with Ukraine right now, where he comes in hard on one side and then goes to the other side. And he's now back on the side of Ukraine after the most recent conversation he had with Zelensky at the UN. It's a little bit of a head spinner, I think, from traditional foreign policy tactics, but it's not out of alignment with, I think, how he wants us and others around the world to view his presidency, that he is going to be the greatest president of all time, and that requires him to deliver on a promise to negotiate a settlement or a peace treaty.
What Amy just described, presidents do have a tendency, particularly in a second term, to turn to trying to negotiate resolutions for conflicts. I think of President Clinton, for example, negotiating an end ceasefire, at least in Northern Ireland, attempting to negotiate an end to the conflict between Israel and Palestine, and was very interested in legacy. Amy just highlighted, I mean, we are not a year into this administration, and President Trump is seemingly quite interested in his legacy. Is that unique for American presidents? Is this driven more by his personality? Or is it fair to say presidents are always concerned with their legacy, and what he's basically doing is taking his second term and kind of treating it always as what's going to drive his legacy?
From my perspective and what I've been reading both in academic circles as well as the general public press, is that this is Trump world. And so, in fact, the he's touting right now seven agreements that he's calling a quote-unquote success. And one of the things that I'd read about is that he's cherry-picking, if you will, the ones that seem to be, you know, easy wins, if you will, with regard to some of these. And one of the criticism is that why isn't he focusing more on the really big issues? Now, this is not to say, I mean, the ones with the Congo and Rwanda and some of these other ones. I mean, if you live there, this is not something that's minor, of course. But, I mean, the really big one that has the potential for World War III, if you will, is the Ukrainian-Russian conflict as well as the Palestine-Israeli conflict. Unfortunately, he switches back and forth depending on how the wind blows, or more likely how his mood is that particular day on that one. But with regard to these other areas, yes, without question, this is about his legacy. In fact, it is almost a brazen bid for the Nobel Prize, which is what has been argued in that regard. And in several of these cases, I mean, the Donald is being the Donald, and that there's a certain degree of over-exaggeration. For example, he's already touting success with the Cambodian skirmish, but they've already, about a week after he announced that, hey, everything's cool, fighting has continued. So, without question, this is about, in the end, it's about his legacy. I mean, granted, it's also a bit ironic because, as Amy had mentioned, under Trump, everybody was more or less expecting that we would become isolationists, that we have now decided to give up, walk away from our role as the quote-unquote world's policeman. And in these cases, that's exactly, we've continued to be the world's policeman, which is actually a good thing for the world, being the world's strongest power militarily as well as economically.
Mary Jane, I'm going to turn to you with this question. If the expectation was the U.S. was going to withdraw from its role in the world, but the president is much more present, even possibly aggressive in these negotiations, do you see this as an indication where the U.S. is likely to continue to play a role in these agreements? Because, for instance, maybe the most famous example of the U.S. asserting itself in a role in negotiations is between Israel and Egypt, the Camp David Accords under Jimmy Carter. And the U.S. has been incredibly engaged since that agreement. So is it fair that the expectation here is that the U.S. is actually signaling in places like negotiating a peace between Armenia and Azerbaijan, Thailand, Cambodia, that the U.S. is actually going to continue to play a large role? Or is this sort of a check-in, sign the agreement, and then expect a check back out? What do you expect?
Thanks, Doug. And, you know, thinking about what my colleagues here just said, I think in light of what we see is Trump's negotiating style and his wanting to build a legacy, I see with his administration, with his policy, I see him continuing to do this if it favors him. And so we could see the attention switch to something else. It was tariffs. Those are still going on, but it was, you know, sort of the tariff wars and now, you know, solving these conflicts. So I think that attention span we're going to see that shifting. You know, long term, I think it'll be sort of could be business as usual, where the U.S. intervenes in according to our own domestic politics, what is considered to be in our own interests. And I was thinking of Camp David, actually, in sort of thinking of the history of U.S. Sort of intervening in negotiations. And that one is, you know, held up as a success. But if you go forward into the Arab or the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you have the Oslo Accords and you have sort of, you know, things have not been resolved. So there's a long term. I think that there gets to be a tiring on the part of the U.S., so certainly the public, to these things. So I don't see, you know, sort of his actions right now necessarily leading to longer term sort of intervention in those particular conflicts.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the role of the United States and the specifically President Trump and the Trump administration in peace negotiations, other forms of negotiations, and the impact that has on the negotiations themselves and the motivations of the United States. Our guests today are Amy Scognessi of San Francisco State University, Mary Jane Parmentier of Arizona State University, and Louis Hebron of Cal State University, Monterey Bay. So with this question, I guess part of where I was thinking with this, and Louis, at this point then, if things end up going badly, do you think that Trump will just walk away from some of these negotiations? So, for instance, he's negotiated ostensibly an end to the war in the DRC between, you know, Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. As somebody who's studied that war, I'm a bit skeptical that war has ended because I've seen lots of peace agreements in that war. And this is not a statement on Trump. This is just a statement on the war. It has this remarkable persistence. Do you think that the U.S. would be expected to withdraw from those negotiations if things get bad? Or has the president taken some ownership of this process because he's declared that he's brought peace?
That's actually an interesting question that you point out, or pose, should I say. Mainly because now we're looking at to what extent is his legacy or his ego going to play out? I mean, for lack of a better term with regard to when I say ego, Trump likes to pride himself on being the deal maker. In fact, one of the pieces that I read is they literally, the title included diplomatic deals, not agreements, not, you know, but an actual deal. And so it would not surprise me if he was to wash his, you know, his hands of it and walk away, basically blaming the participants in it. But at the same time, I think he would try to make it work. And, you know, and at the very least, you know, saying, hey, he took his best shot and it just wasn't there. You know, that he did use the full force of American power, militarily, diplomatically, politically, economically, to try to end the war. You know, I mean, I actually take him very seriously when he focuses on the fact that these, you know, that the fighting has to stop, the killing has to stop. You know, he didn't say deaths. When I've, you know, seen him on interviews in the news, he said killing. And so I think that is one of the things that it is part of his core. And so he's adamant about, you know, at least at the very least getting a ceasefire, if not a full-on agreement to end it.
Amy, I know you study the impact of more right-wing movements, and so it's sort of in the light of that. At one level, the right in the United States, particularly as represented by Donald Trump, again, was more isolationist. But there's also a real sort of moral core to these questions, in particular when thinking about the impact, say, of, you know, Christianity and Christian nationalism. How much is this motivation, one where, again, he talks a lot about we need to stop the killing, we need to end the violence, and so therefore, if there's a new outbreak of war, that could really compel an even greater response, I would imagine. What do you think?
That's an interesting question. I think, you know, if we think about it from the standpoint of, like, what did I expect with Trump coming back at a second term as an IR person, as an IR professional and academic, I think one of the things that studying right-wing populism that I did expect is that, you know, Trump is known as his first personality. He's a typical right-wing populist type of personality. And people have studied this in terms of the types of negotiations they want to have, the foreign policies they want to have. And one thing I think that he's good at is presenting foreign policy problems as caricatures in theater or something like that, as a show. So if we think of who does he like to deal with and who are the personalities of the people that are involved in some of these conflict situations. And in particular, if you just think of like Putin and Zelensky, here you have two very well-known politicians, even in the United States. It's a really complicated history, obviously, that other presidents have been involved in as well. But what's interesting is when you watch how Trump approaches negotiations with them. So most recently when he met with Putin in Alaska, as an example, that was so scripted to fit what I would describe as a typical approach of President Trump. He went into it with setting the expectations that he was going to be able to negotiate with Putin. He was going to go toe-to-toe with him. He had the long red carpet. They met on the walkway. He has it all laid out as a piece of television, basically. And then when it didn't seem to be received very well in the American press, he immediately downplays it as you know, he still won in the negotiation and he still, you know, the deal was still in progress, but he still is committed to trying to get it done quickly. So as soon as it backfires, he steps back from it. At the UN, we see the same thing with Zelensky. He all of a sudden is saying that he's, you know, flips his position completely and is in support of Zelensky. I think for the Christian right in the United States, for the most part, in those cases, I would say I don't know their position exactly. But when it comes to Israel, for example, you know, they are very supportive of Israel. And you can see that his relationship with Netanyahu is another example of one where Trump is really influenced by the leader of another country. And I think this is concerning and different from the typical American president's approach to negotiations, where they might have rapport with another leader, but they typically don't go at it as personally as Trump does. The fact that Netanyahu was able to convince Trump to drop missiles on Iran, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I heard that news, I was shocked that the U.S. military was going to do something like that. That was not something we would have seen from any past president, I thought it was pretty reckless, actually. But then in the end, of course, people didn't react in the same way that we might have expected. And I think it shows that Trump is willing to take great risks. And the more he does it, the more people acquiesce to him to a degree. And it's really interesting to see it unfold. So I think he turns typical IR relations on their head, and we're left spinning, trying to figure out how to analyze this and what to do.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. Although I would like to point out one of the things that got me thinking about that question is one of these conflicts, and that's the conflict between DRC and Rwanda, that there is a pretty, you know, quite well engaged relationship in Christian, particularly evangelical communities in Rwanda. And I mean, that is an area where there's a lot of missionary work that's being done. There's a lot of engagement, which made me wonder if that was what was driving that. But it actually raises to me an interesting question, because if the perspective is coming from Rwanda, my own perspective is that war is largely driven by the fact that Rwanda remains in the DRC and, quite frankly, has had these extractive policies. And how much is the U.S. going to be committed to doing, to engaging in the very hard tactic of telling Rwanda, you have to get out of the DRC or else there's going to be a conflict, if this has all been framed by Rwanda? You're not even familiar with this. Your thoughts?
I'm not as familiar with this case as you are. I think more needs to be done in terms of who is really behind many of these foreign policy moves on the behalf of the Trump administration. It's not the typical people that we think of when we think of the foreign policy bureaucracy. It's clearly not the State Department or intelligence officers. And I think there's more there to unpack between what's happening with Stephen Miller and the right-wing Christian nationalists. I really think there's a whole behind-the-scenes push on what is, and I don't know enough about this yet, but I think this is a really ripe area. It's like the non-traditional drivers of foreign policy are coming to the fore in a way that we aren't expecting. And so I think there might be something there. That's a really good point.
But Mary Jane, you have some response as well.
Thanks. So yeah, Amy, thinking about your comments, I keep trying to see what the reactions are outside of the United States. There was a BBC article just the other day looking at all of the conflicts that you've mentioned, Doug, and kind of assessing each one, right, and trying to be very sort of objective and, you know, did he actually solve these conflicts? And as I was reading it, I was writing down the conclusions for all but one, and I'll mention the one, maybe you all have seen the article, but the conclusion is unclear, unclear, unclear. And it's because of what you said, Amy. We don't exactly know. And I had also made notes, you know, when I was thinking about this, the fact that negotiations take time. They take lots of time. You remember Camp David and shuttle diplomacy and all of that. It's not done, you know, with a few comments here and there. And, you know, the Trump administration has said, oh, we worked all night long to solve this conflict. But, you know, who and how? We just don't know, right? The one conflict they said, like, okay, U.S. intervention might have helped here was actually the military confrontation between Israel and Iran, where the threat of U.S. Power, right, they said, yeah, that could have actually ended that conflict for now, even though it seems like a highly risky and dangerous thing.
And one conflict we haven't mentioned yet, Louis, I'll turn to you first for this, but you all can respond to this, is India and Pakistan. Because I think there's two things going on here. First of all, if you're following that conflict, the impact of, say, of nuclear diplomacy, the fact that both countries have nuclear weapons, and that seems to at least have compelled both countries to be incredibly concerned about escalation. And so to say the U.S. negotiated that ceasefire, that peace, it's really quite complicated. But the question I have for you is, it seems that the U.S.'s assertion that they negotiated that peace has angered some of the actors, and most notably has angered Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Are there consequences for the U.S. taking responsibility with the local actors if there's a perception that the U.S., that President Trump is trying to take credit for work that other actors have actually done?
Yeah, you raise a very important point there, because the relationship that the U.S. has with both these countries, both India and Pakistan, is chess, three-dimensional chess. It's probably the best way to describe it. And the reason why I say that is because they are at once, well, actually, instead of saying that, they are basically frenemies, for lack of a better term. And the reason why is because it is in both Pakistan, India and the U.S. interest to get along, play nice, cooperate. But at the same time, India is also part of the BRICS, which is right now being led by China and Russia, who are part of the Axis of Chaos, Axis of Ill Will. I mean, there's a whole host of names there that are basically trying to dismantle the current liberal international organization in place since the end of the Second World War. But speaking directly to your question about would Trump taking a bow, you know, in negotiating, right, from my understanding right now, it's a ceasefire, not so much, because it hasn't been formally declared. So at least a ceasefire is, yeah, absolutely, because Modi himself is having issues at home. And so this is actually a win internationally that he needs, that he wants.
Right?
Yeah, in India. Yeah. I'm not as familiar on the Pakistan perspective in this situation. But what it comes down to is that the second key point is that India could potentially be an important economic partner for the United States. Moving factories and getting, reducing the trade deficit that the U.S. has. This was definitely, in my reading of it, is a misstep on the part of Trump. Mm. I mean, at best, he probably could have said, I'm happy to help, but not as the picture that he's painting is that he was the lead on this, that if it weren't up, if it weren't for me, these two guys would have never gotten to the negotiation table and all that other stuff, which could a certain extent be true, but this is where diplomacy comes in, where you don't really need to see how the sausage is made.
When we come back, I really want to examine what's motivating the United States. We've talked a lot about what's motivating President Trump, but I'd like to go broadly into what national interests could be. And in particular, I'd like to focus our attention on the way in which the U.S. has asserted rights for purchasing things like rare earth metals and other mining concessions in some of these agreements, including I think of the DRC and Rwanda, and one conflict we haven't talked about yet that I want to make sure that we do is between Azerbaijan and Armenia.
When we come back, with the United States inserted into international conflict negotiations, will it remain embedded and engaged in those regions? What will be the consequences of these actions? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. With Donald Trump inserting himself and the United States into multiple conflicts, what will this mean for those regions and especially for the stability of the agreements? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're talking about the role the United States has played in playing a role in negotiating peace in a couple of places, ceasefires. In some cases, these are economic deals. For instance, water sharing deal between Ethiopia and Egypt, and what this means for the deals themselves and what's motivating the United States. Our guests today are Amy Scognessi. She's the professor of international relations at San Francisco State University. Mary Jane Parmienter. She is the clinical professor and deputy director of the School of the Future of Innovation and Society and the director of global programs at Arizona State University. And Louis Hebron, formerly of California State University, Monterey Bay. So returning back to this, Amy, I'll go ahead and ask you this first. How much is the United States being motivated here? And I know this is part of the narrative about trying to negotiate a peace between Russia and Ukraine. There were some expectations about rare earth metals. The DRC, one of the reasons why Rwanda's in the Democratic Republic of the Congo is because it's so rich in metals. And also what the United States sought out of the negotiations between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Is this a way that the United States is just trying to get rich off these agreements?
Great question. I think when we think of the United States' interests in negotiating ceasefires or participating in negotiations, typically we think of them as wanting to maintain their status as like a global hegemon or as a great peacekeeper, as a negotiator, as continuing the American exceptionalist legacy in a way. I now feel like you maybe do, that there's a little bit of skepticism as to why the administration is choosing these particular conflicts to get involved with. Even with Ukraine, there's more talk of what the strategic gains could be on the part of the United States, rather than simply, if we think about what the talk was under Biden, which was helping a democratic ally, a member of, the Europe against Russia, kind of that sort of pivot of a democracy against a more tyrannical invasion. right? Those are sort of the interests that are being shared. Instead, now you hear that there's, what is the gain, the financial gain or the deal that's going to be brought to the United States? That puts it more in line with transactional types of negotiations. We want something from you. We're going to help you, but we want something from you. And I think now that we're, as Louis mentioned earlier, you know, we're really seeing a shift in the rise of China and Russia as really global powers now. They are seeing themselves as global powers. And when we think about technological advances, et cetera, I think the U.S. is looking to position itself to be able to have access themselves to rare earth minerals or other kinds of minerals that are needed for technological gains that they might not otherwise have.
Yeah. Louis, you had some thoughts on that as well.
Yes, I'm actually glad that Amy introduced the term hegemony. With regard to rare earths, China is the hegemonic power. I mean, they have right now, at least in terms of accessibility to rare earths, 90% of the world is what they have. And so, and this is not to say that, you know, it's available elsewhere, but they can't mine it fast enough. I mean, the United States actually has a large deposit of that itself. And so about 2 weeks ago, there was a negotiation that was a deal ironed out, maybe it was earlier or later, between China and the United States. You know, the threat that Trump was willing to impose on China suddenly disappeared. The reason why was because China basically put a checkmate on the United States in the area of rare earths. Because they basically said that, you know, unless you get rid of this or, you know, you lower it, we are literally going to stop sending these rare earth materials that you need for all your AI tools and everything. And so that's why Trump had to back down. And China is also playing this game, and so that is one of their strategy in these countries. They are also cherry-picking in terms of which countries they are willing to cut a deal with because of those rare earth sources. You know, I mean, one of the big breakdowns of the when Trump literally embarrassed, I can't pronounce his name, the president of Ukraine, was because there was supposed to be a deal in place for their U.S. access to their rare earth materials. That's where the breakdown came in. Not so much that he, you know, I mean, the line that was given was because Zelensky, hey, I said it, was asking too much in terms of armaments. Now, it was actually, what was not seen was the breakdown in terms of what the price was for those armaments, which was access to, you know, a good situation for the U.S. in access to those rare earths.
What we're describing here I find really interesting because at one level, the lens that we IR scholars might use might be, you know, just good old-fashioned realism. There's a competition between the U.S. and China, and the U.S. is trying to negotiate these deals as a way to try to keep China out of that. And by the way, the U.S. has a long tradition of that. Its engagement in Middle East negotiations throughout most of the Cold War was basically a means to keep the Soviets out of the Middle East. And so I guess part of me is thinking that's the question. But another one that I think we need to raise here is the idea that if I'm going to negotiate this, I expect to get my cut. And is one of the reasons scholars are struggling with this is because Donald Trump is not a typical leader. And what makes him very atypical is he's a businessman. So is what we're seeing here, that we're kind of associating to Trump's personality, really the way in which business leaders view negotiations? Amy, I'll ask you first, but for the entire panel.
I think you're raising a really important issue because it's not really realism when you think about it that way. It's not about power. It's not about great power status or even alliances or anything that we typically associate with realism. It's really transactional. In that case, it almost has to do more with economic incentives. We'll support you in your war against Russia, but we want an economic gain from that. This isn't completely apart from what a lot of U.S. Negotiations have been in the past, but I think you're right that Trump sees everything through that transactional lens, and maybe that is his framework in terms of a business, his business perspective. I think when he talks about making deals, as Louis says, rather than negotiations, he's making deals. Deals mean you win. right? You win something more than the other person, or you both win something, right? But the U.S. wants to get its take. If we think about the way that Trump views international institutions or NATO or even with the UN, the U.S. plays itself as being taken advantage of and not as paying way more than its share, and that other nations need to contribute more, and that it's unequal. Trade deals the same way, right? The U.S. is getting bad deals in the past because it's been taken advantage of, and the deals aren't equal. That, to me, is the negotiation strategy here, which is that we want to take something from you if we're going to give you something.
Hey, Mary Jane, go ahead.
Yeah, so as we're talking about this, I'm thinking of, you know, theories of conflict resolution, right, and theories, and there's this idea that the intervener, the person who resolves the conflict, is neutral. And clearly we're not seeing that. And with transactional negotiations, that's not an element, right, the neutrality. So if we go back to India, Pakistan, you know, I mean, if you actually look at U.S. intervention in conflicts, any great power, any power, you know, regional power, it's more likely that there isn't neutrality in most cases, right? There's one side that's backed more than the other. And India-Pakistan is interesting, of course, because we've had, you know, we've had nuclear relations with both countries, right, and supported that. But in this case, what the way it was done angered, you know, the Prime Minister of India. The extraction is making me think of Latin America, which is a region of the world we haven't talked about yet. But how this plays in other contexts and how this plays, I've spent a lot of time in Brazil just in the last 6 months. And, you know, the intervention of the U.S. in Latin America and extractive industries is well known. Maybe not in the U.S. as much, but in Latin America it certainly is. And so this plays out as very neocolonial, actually. And great power competition in a way for those resources, right? And then the more recent intervention in the attempt to intervene in Brazilian domestic politics also has this very, you know, bad resonation connotation throughout Latin America and U.S. intervention in toppling governments and so forth for U.S. interests. And I haven't talked to anybody since the mining incident or the interests have come up, but I think this would just play very badly in Latin America.
Go ahead, Louis.
Geoeconomics has been weaponized by Trump. And by that, I mean that economics has become a tool for geopolitics. I mean, and this is nothing new, but nothing as blatant as this before. And you know, I mean, during the whole hyper-globalization stage from basically 1990 until 2000, geopolitics actually went to the back burner, and geoeconomics was the one was in the front burner. That's what it was all about, you know, raising all boats. We have peace, so we can actually focus on. Since we have peace, we can now focus on prosperity. Okay, now that peace, which is founded on international security based on American power, is falling by the wayside, or at least as my colleagues have mentioned, is no longer that important, at least to this administration, or they're willing to give it up to cede that. That's what we're seeing now. And so it becomes even, economics and politics are, you know, depending on how this, what the situation is, the scales move back and forth in terms of one is playing a larger role than the other. But make no mistake about it, I mean, they're both tools now in international relations.
Yeah, absolutely. Amy, you had some thoughts as well.
I just wanted to add in to what Mary Jane was saying about neutrality and the fact that, you know, all of a sudden you have a situation where you're not really seeking neutrality, whether or not it was perfect in the past, you're not even really seeking that at all. I think the other thing that's been stripped away from the way that Trump enters into any international negotiation situation is the complete stripping away of values and human rights. This is pretty unprecedented when it comes to U.S. involvement in negotiations and resolving conflicts. Typically, the reason that the U.S. gets involved in resolving conflicts is in terms of trying to set the to promote, basically, human rights. I think of Gaza as just a classic example. The fact that Trump goes in, talks to Netanyahu about the war in Gaza and describes it as the perfect beachfront property where he's going to build hotels, it's almost like the disconnect between what is going on as what would be a typical goal of U.S. foreign policy there, which is to at least attempt to intervene and lessen the damage or lessen the loss of human rights and lives and civilian lives. It's all about transaction. Just the fact that he could even visualize something like a beach resort in Gaza, to me, says that there's some huge, huge change in the way that the United States is approaching foreign policy resolution.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the role that the United States, and particularly the Trump administration, is playing in peace negotiations from around the world. Our guests today are Amy Scognessi of San Francisco State University, Mary Jane Parmentier of Arizona State University, and Louis Hebron of Cal State University, Monterey Bay. And Mary Jane, you raised the issue about neutrality. And one of the things, and I'm thinking in particular, one of these negotiations we haven't talked about yet is Armenia and Azerbaijan, that this was a negotiation that, frankly, a reminder, a huge number of peace negotiations are not give and take, each side gives something up in order, you know, to achieve a peace. This was a case where Azerbaijan defeated Armenia militarily, and they were negotiating the terms of Armenia's surrender. And then President Trump becomes a part of this negotiation. And the lack of neutrality was known by both sides because explicitly both Azerbaijan and Armenia were reaching out to the U.S. to make offers to the U.S. to see if there might be just a little something they can get out of these negotiations if the U.S., you know, is playing that role. So is Trump playing a card here where, since he's choosing to not be neutral, but we also said he's inconsistent, that he's literally telling the actors, I'm here, figure out how to get me to side with you, and then therefore I'm able to get things from the negotiations. And as a negotiation tactic, is that challenging for the peace negotiations, or is he just playing a different game?
Oh, I think it's very challenging and risky for actual peace negotiations, right? Because then the U.S. power becomes another card. It becomes another card that can be played by any side. It can become irrelevant or it can be used, and the U.S. might have actually no control over how that's used. A lack of understanding of the region, it kind of goes back to what we were saying, who's actually doing the negotiating, where's the information coming from. U.S. has a long history of making decisions about other countries of which they lack information, or they have the information, but they lack the knowledge and the decision-making, I might say. I mean, we've seen that in many cases. It's dangerous. It's a dangerous precedent, actually.
Louis, what do you think? Is President Trump playing kind of masterfully to get the parties to offer concessions to the United States? Or is he, because he doesn't have the same sort of political negotiation backgrounds, maybe there's some more risk that there needs to be?
I would fall on the area of probably there is more risk. And you are correct. And the reason for that is because he is playing a different game. He's not a diplomat, he's a businessman. And at the end of the day, it's about really coming to a deal. And so, I mean, when you described about him going to each country, basically saying, what do you got for me so I can, you know, get to the other side and let's cut this deal. That's exactly what happens in business, and so that's how he operates. And unfortunately for both these two countries, he's basically set the new rules of how the game is to be played. Mm-hmm. So the other thing, I mean, getting back to the seven agreements and all that, I mean, I was just reviewing my notes here. It still has to be ratified. You know, it still has to go through the normal process of that. And I think I mentioned that it still has they still have to check whether or not it's constitutional, whether or not they can actually sign this the agreement, the peace treaty and everything.
Part of that was because Azerbaijan was demanding Armenia permanently surrender any claims to the, you know, Nagorno-Karabakh Artsakh region, which is actually a part of the Armenian constitution. I have to admit, I never assumed this agreement could be implemented until there was like a constitutional vote. So therefore, there's still a lot that needs to be done in order to achieve this. And for the record, why would Armenia do this? They lost the war, and they're negotiating the terms of the surrender, you know, at this point, which is a reminder that these peace agreements, a peace agreement, shaking the hands of leaders, starts the process. It doesn't end it. Amy, your thoughts on this as well? Is the lack of neutrality just a kind of a wonderful technique, at least a challenging technique, a technique, let me just take the adjective away, a technique the U.S. is using in order to get concessions?
I think what Mary Jane said is really apt here. When you're playing that game and you're deciding that you are going to become a partner to the negotiations with your own interests, your own intent, your own desire to get something out of it, it really puts you in a position, I think, of losing international credibility immediately. So then it's very obvious. And whereas in the past there may have been some gain for the U.S. negotiating, let's say, the Oslo Peace Accords or whatever, it wasn't a transactional gain economically. It was more of a gain in standing and in being an international player that can look to solve conflicts, to show leadership in the world. And when you're taking it as a way to have personal gain for your own country or economic gains or seeing who can come to you with the best deal, you know, you're really ruling, like many other leaders around the world, that we have thought we're not good leaders. You're modeling for the rest of the world that that's okay, and you're putting yourself in a position also where you're assuming that you can out-negotiate other leaders like Putin, for example, and who's to say, you know, how Putin's going to be responding to what Trump has done recently in Ukraine? You know, he's not going to like that information. So it's putting yourself in a position where you're losing potential allies. And I think mainly the credibility of the United States is really, really on the line here. That's been kind of the case for a while. And many scholars have talked about the U.S., you know, a hegemon in decline, the demise of the liberal international order, for better or worse. And that really puts a position for other leaders to take equal role.
I think at this point, we're going to actually turn to the audience and have an opportunity for questions. But as you start thinking about asking those questions, I think it's fair to say one of the themes that I hope we take from this is a lot of the political narrative about Donald Trump and, you know, the seven peace agreements, whatever, is that, first of all, he's taking credit far too soon. He's, to use a football analogy, spiking the football at the first down. And though I don't disagree with that, I think there's so much more going on than that question. He certainly has a tendency to take credit well before he probably should be taking credit. But I think we've raised some core issues as to what exactly the strategy is for President Trump. And even more importantly, a reminder that though we may be hearing that we have these agreements and there's peace in these areas, those of us who study international relations, study conflict resolution, a reminder that this sort of starts the process, it doesn't end it. Amy, did you have a response?
I think it's important to think through, you mentioned early, like, what is the tradition of American foreign policy and how does his leadership fit into that? Just the fact that we're even talking about him resolving seven conflicts in such a short period of time, along with a number of other issues we've raised. What are his priorities? What are his foreign policy priorities? I don't know. Typically, you know, a president might come in with an agenda of a certain number of foreign policy priorities, and then you can evaluate whether or not they've achieved those in a certain amount of time. I think right now there's so many different issues that the president wants to or is involved with that it's hard to really pin down any priorities or grand strategy here.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And the question about grand strategy versus an administration, and he's not unique with this, but I think perhaps uniquely aware so early on that he's reactive to a lot of these issues as opposed to being more strategic. Though I'm not going to be the one to argue that we need another Henry Kissinger and this notion of grand strategy. But I think that's a good point and where some of the issues about questions of consistency. So,
I'm Amy Bailo from California State University East Bay, and I wanted to ask a question for all three of you. We've been talking about how Trump's foreign policy is concerning, risky, dangerous. Are there any aspects of his policy so far that you could say are advantageous or may have some benefits in the medium or long term?
Go ahead, Mary Jane.
Thank you, Amy. So I don't know if I'm going to be directly saying something positive or advantageous, but you sparked something that I had been thinking of. And I'm wondering if it's allowing the U.S. as the emperor to have no clothes. And by that, I mean, and I'm thinking of my other colleague, Amy, comments about, you know, there's no narrative about human rights. There's no morality, right, which is really disturbing. But on the other hand, if we look at U.S. interventions after World War II, we see many instances of intervention for U.S. national economic interests only, right, overthrowing democratically elected governments in the Middle East and in Latin America. In another play, we've seen this happening over and over. So I guess my question back to everyone is this just, you know, it's sort of the veil is removed. I'm not saying I necessarily think that. It's just what I'm this discussion is provoking in my mind.
So I'm going to give an answer where I think it is actually interestingly advantageous. And that is the U.S. is asserting itself in areas that it typically is kind of sat out. Thailand and Cambodia. The issue of the dam between Egypt and Ethiopia, that's been out there for quite some time. And the president has taken on that issue and decided he wouldn't have an impact there. And so we've been having a very serious discussion about how positive the impact is going to be. But the fact that you have an American administration that for all the talk about the expectation that there was going to be an isolationism and withdrawal, has actually been quite the opposite. It's been engaged in areas around the world. And I can tell you from the show's perspective, we tend to cover conflicts that don't get talked about much in the press. And it seems like the president cares about some of these conflicts. So there's at least an opening that the U.S. could play a role in a lot of places around the world that especially recently they haven't been playing, though I can understand some degree of skepticism about that, because we have to ask why there's that interest. And it's part of that because there's rare earth metals and there's deals that need to be made, et cetera. But I think the U.S. becoming more engaged rather, this time last year, I don't think anybody would have predicted that we'd be talking about the increased engagement of the United States coming out of a Trump administration as opposed to a lesser engagement, I think that's positive. Lou, you want to respond?
My response is twofold. First, with regard to the question regarding Trump, I believe there's a method to his madness that, you know, prematurely declaring a victory allows him that if it does fall through to say, hey, we gave it our best shot, we were willing to negotiate, we wanted it, and they're the ones who walked away. So in that regard, it's almost like a no-lose situation for him, contrary to what the rest of us believe, that why are you declaring it, before it's done. The second part is, I don't know if it was Amy or Mary Jane who mentioned about the human rights. One of my current area of research right now that I'm working on is on the liberal international order, Under Siege, working title. One of the big criticism is that it kind of expanded too much from what its core mission and purpose was, which is to bring about an order so that peace and prosperity can flourish. Okay, and by focusing on the focus on human rights is being misdirected. The focus on human rights should be in the area of better working conditions, a livable wage, because that focuses on the prosperity part. And so, which at the same time it distracts away from the strict human rights part, but then it also forces your attention to like, all right, there is a certain degree of human rights if you are able to, live beyond $2 a day and all that. And in fact, among Asian cultures, human rights is tied more towards the economic realm rather than the political realm. For the most part, the reason why China is succeeding, at least until recently, with, the unemployed college graduates, is because they were given what they wanted and needed, which is to be able to live their lives and be economically free from the communist system. In exchange for that, stay out of politics. And they were more than willing to sign off on that bargain. So one of the solutions would be, yes, focus on human rights, but indirectly. and by focusing it more on economic sustainability and a living wage, that sort of thing.
You think the U.S. is going to pursue this?
No, not just in the U.S., but in general. Perhaps maybe redirect how to make the liberal international order workable. And perhaps the first step of that is to get rid of the liberal aspect, the certain segments of the liberal part.
Hmm. I want to thank the panel for answering these questions. This was a very big, broad, sweeping conversation. We take this opportunity to thank everybody. We've been discussing Trump's foreign policy and specifically the role that he has played in helping to negotiate different agreements from nations around the world. And is this consistent with American foreign policy? And what does this mean for the peace agreements? Our panel today has been Amy Scognessi. She is professor of international relations at San Francisco State University, the co-author of U.S. Foreign Policy, that's with Stephen Hook, and The Trump Effect, the Perpetuation of Populism in U.S.-China Trade, that's with Ancita Sherrell. Mary Jane Parmentier, she is clinical professor and deputy director of the School of the Future of Innovation and Society, the director of global programs at the Rob Walton School of Global Futures at Arizona State University. She's the author of Cross-National Active Learning in Global Development Studies, Decolonizing the Curriculum, and co-author of A Co-Created Model for Self-Determined Development Objectives in Indigenous Communities. And Louis Hebron, formerly of California State University, Monterey Bay, and is the editor of Asian Security in the Age of Globalization, working on a book on the defending the international liberal order. And I want to thank you all for sharing your time and your expertise with us and joining the show.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.